works and why it gives optimal results for characterization and existence of eigenvalues. Okay, so I remind you that yesterday I began by looking at the kind of min-max approach to describe the eigenvalues of operators H0 plus B, where H0 was the Dirac operator. And I followed first a direct variational approach to prove that actually these numbers, which I describe by this inf sub, are actually eigenvalues of the operator when I have some good assumptions on the potentials. And to prove that, I needed some Hardy inequalities, which in the optimal case, the best I could use the Hardy inequalities, which are known, didn't give the optimal result for the potentials. Okay? So that's why I explained why we wanted to change a little bit the approach and look at this problem in another way. Okay, so I stated this theorem yesterday, so I recall very quickly the theorem. So we have a family of operators, A nu. So the parameter, now I put it here, so the A nu, A0, fixed self-adjoint operator, plus nu V, and V I take a bounded potential for simplicity, and we'll see that actually we can do things with unbounded potentials later. So all these operators are self-adjoint for nu in some interval I, they all have the same domain, PA0. I denote by mu key nu the kth eigenvalue of the operator A nu, so this is notation. And I assume, this is an assumption, that the space, the basic space, which in our case is L2 or H1/2, can be decomposed as the sum, direct sum of two spaces, for which I have the corresponding projectors. And the assumptions, I didn't write all of them, but the basic assumptions are the following. First, I define the number which is the supremum of the Rayleigh quotient on the space F minus. F is some space which is dense in the domain. Okay? So I just work with regular functions. In our case, it will be always say infinity with compact support functions. So I take the projection of that space with the P minus projection. So P F plus and minus is P plus minus of some nice space. So I look at the supremum of the Rayleigh quotient on that space, and I assume that all these numbers which depend on nu are bounded uniformly by some constant A nu, A minus, excuse me. Second assumption, I assume that the first eigenvalue is always above some constant for every nu in the interval, which is strictly above A minus. There's a little gap there. They can be very close, but it's strictly, and all this uniform in nu. And the last assumption is that lambda 1, 0 is larger than A minus also, and the lambdas are the numbers I defined yesterday, so are the min-maxes here. So I minimize with respect to all subspaces of F plus with dimension K, and I maximize in the space G direction with F minus.
Assumption does not guarantee that you have eigenvalues.
No.
It's part of
that. Yes. If there is no eigenvalue, then there is nothing.
Yes.
Okay. Well, of the all the min maxes will be the next point in the essential spectrum. Okay, so the theorem says that we have all those assumptions, all the eigenvalues are given by the min maxes. So these min maxes are the eigenvalues, they exist. If they don't exist, they will all be equal to the first point in the essential spectrum above A minus. Okay, so in that case we don't say anything. And so what this theorem says is that if the eigenvalues exist and we have all these assumptions, the eigenvalues, which for example we can know their existence by some qualitative result saying if the potential is such and such, then we have an infinity of eigenvalues. But we don't know how to compute them, how to characterize them. This theorem says that the eigenvalues, if they exist and if we have all these assumptions, they are equal to these min maxes. Yes?
Above
this one.
Above
A minus, yes. Yes, well, this is the. We are speaking only above A minus. Okay, maybe there are other gaps below. Okay. So, So yes, so these eigenvalues are k eigenvalue above a minus. Okay. We can look at different gaps, for example, but we are looking just in this case at one gap. Okay, so this theorem says this thing, and so we are. I'm going to try to analyze a case, a simple case, a simple example, in detail to show how to use and how to verify all these assumptions. So the nice thing about this is that I am not going to verify directly by hand that these min maxes are eigenvalues. Because if I do so, I would need hard inequalities. And in some cases, I will not have enough hard inequalities. Okay? So I'm not going to verify directly that these are eigenvalues. Actually, the proof of this theorem is based on some spectral theories, not direct variational approach. Okay? So and the interest of this is, as I explained yesterday and as I will see, later, is that this is going to cover more wider classes of potentials, first, and second, we will see that actually it will be a nicer approach when we want really to compute eigenvalues. And the reason for that is that in this theorem, well, you remember yesterday when I introduced the min-maxes, the positive and negative spaces were related to the spectral decomposition corresponding to the free Dirac operator. So it was a precise decomposition. In this theorem, I don't say which decomposition we are taking. I say there is a decomposition with corresponding projectors. So I can take different decompositions. Okay? And we will see that in the case of Dirac operators, there is one which is much nicer than the spectral decomposition when one wants to compute the eigenvalues. Okay, so I'm going now to consider a particular case and analyze in detail things. So I'm going to consider the case of some... I will consider operators A0 plus B with B between minus nu over X and 0, just for simplicity. Okay? And I will take nu between 0 and 1. And I'm going to explain why nu between 0 and 1. So in order to explain things, let me recall some basic results, quite classical, about the Coulomb potential. So let's take exactly the case of Coulomb potential. So let's now look at the particular case A0 minus nu over X. Well, for this operator, one can compute everything explicitly. And what is known is the following thing. For nu between 0 and 1, one can define this operator as a self-adjoint operator. This, I don't want to enter into details. This is complicated because actually there are two ranges here. There is the range 0 less than nu less than square root of 3 over 2, in which the operator is essentially self-adjoint, and the domain is H1. And then afterwards, between a square root of 3 over 2, I don't know exactly at the equality what happens, and less than 1, there is a particular extension, which is self-adjoint, but 1, with domain strictly between H1 and H1 half. So it's a little bit strange, but I don't want to go into this details, but just to say that, one has to be careful about self-adjointness in this case, and when one passes beyond one, there is no self-extension with self-adjoint extension, which is well-defined. So we have this to begin with. So if we want to apply this theorem with self-adjoint operators, we will be to stay in the interval 0, 1, first thing. Second thing, the eigenvalues are computable explicitly, and the first eigenvalue of H0 minus nu over X is equal to the square root of 1 minus nu square, which is positive for all nu in the interval 0, 1. Okay. And the last result I want to recall is that now, it's more recent results, if I take a potential which is between 0 and the Coulomb potential in the range nu between 0 and 1, then V is also self-adjoint, can be defined as self-adjoint, with domain between H1 and H1 half, and the first eigenvalue of H0 plus B will be larger than 1 minus nu square. Then we have this. Nu is comprised between the Coulomb potential 0, and so the eigenvalue is going to be bounded below by the eigenvalue of the exact of this exact operator. Okay, so these are the things I need now to use that theorem to analyze this case completely. Okay, so in the case of the Coulomb potential, everything is known explicitly. But we don't have always the Coulomb potential exactly. We can have other potentials in relevant models. And so we want to know how to define the eigenvalues and how to compute them.
So now we use the theorem that you showed us in the first lecture to know that eigenvalue on those operator exists. So you take care of the first assumption.
Yeah, there are theorems in the physics literature saying that you have this and this behavior for the potential, you have an infinity of eigenvalues, for example. Okay, so the question is that I cannot apply directly the theorem to this case because I am not saying that B is bounded. We have some singularity. So what we have to do is to, for example, we have to cut the singularity. So, for example, if we were thinking about the potential, the exact Coulomb potential, we just can cut the singularity by adding some epsilon here. And what happens is that we have, we can apply the theorem to this case because now for epsilon fixed, this is going to be about the potential. And what happens is that if we look at the first eigenvalue again of this, since we have an order, this is also larger than 1 minus nu squared. So we have an estimate for the eigenvalues which is independent on epsilon. So what one has to do is to apply the theorem, cutting the singularity, and then we use the a priori estimates and we can pass to the limit and obtain the same result for the unbounded potential. But it's difficult to state such a theorem for unbounded potentials because, for example, I couldn't say in that case, in the case to the Coulomb case, I couldn't say that the domain is the same for all the family of operators. So it's a mess because I have to change the domains, I have to change the projectors, etc. So it's better to, even in the case in which things work well for an unbounded potential, it's much better to cut the singularities, use this kind of continuation argument, and pass to the limit afterwards. Okay, so things work perfectly for this kind of unbounded potentials. Okay, so let me now verify that all the assumptions of this theorem work perfectly for this case. So, I will not play with the epsilon, so I will take epsilon equal to 0. Things work fine for epsilon positive, and then we can pass to the limit. So let me check the assumptions of the theorem on this case. So we can, first thing, that is self-adjoint, etc. It's just what I was saying here. And now let's check something about which kind of decomposition we can take and these assumptions here. So we could take, as yesterday, the spectral decomposition corresponding to the free Dirac operator, but I don't want to do that here. I want to take a decomposition which is much nicer and much more convenient, which is the following one. I'm going to decompose all spinors, so remember that we are working with spinors, which go from functions which go from R3 to C4. And as in the first lecture, I'm going to decompose the spinors in upper and lower spinor. So I'm going to write psi as phi chi, with phi and chi, functions which go from R3 into C. Okay?
Can I ask again, what's the motivation for considering different projectors? Somehow the eigenvalues at the end that you want to get should be independent of which one you took.
Yeah, but we are going to see that, There are splittings with projections which make computations much more easy. Okay, so we are going to see that with this splitting I'm going to consider here, I can compute things quite easily. Okay, so what I am going to do is to write that the vector phi chi is equal to phi 0 plus 0 chi. This is a splitting. And I'm going to call this space the positive space, and this space the negative space. Just it's not positive or negative, but I'm going to call them like that. So the functions phi 0 will be positive space, and the other one the negative space. And of course, this is an orthogonal decomposition. Okay, so you are going to see that things get very easy with the decomposition. So I'm going to compute things. And in order to compute things, I'm going to compute for this kind of decomposition, I'm going to compute the, to write down the Rayleigh quotient, because I'm going to need to say things about this this lambda case, for example, to see the third assumption. So I want to write down what this Rayleigh quotient is in this case. So in this case, H0 plus V phi chi over phi chi, this is the Rayleigh quotient. I just compute explicitly by using the Pauli Dirac matrices. And this is just the integral of V plus 1 phi square, V minus 1 chi square, plus 2 real part of L phi chi over the integral of phi square plus chi square. And L, I remind you the notation of the other day, is the operator minus I sigma x.
The relation between H plus and F plus is that F plus is the plus
H. F plus will be the set of phi zero such that phi is in C infinity compact support of R3 into C2. It's just a dense subset of H plus. Okay, so I wrote down here the Rayleigh quotient explicitly because I'm going to use it all the time. Okay, and I recall that L is a first order operator which is minus I sigma delta, and the sigmas are the Pauli matrices, constant coefficient matrices 2 by 2. Okay, so now I'm going to compute things. Okay, so well, maybe I didn't. Well, it's not important. Okay, so I have to compute this thing. So first thing, I have to compute the supremum of the Rayleigh quotient over the negative space. Negative space means that I have only the lower component, no phi, only chi. Okay, so I look at that, and I look at that for phi equals zero. So I look at element zero chi, and that means that my Rayleigh quotient is equal to V minus 1 chi square over chi square. Okay? And I am making the assumptions that V is non-positive, so this thing is always less than minus chi square. Okay? Excuse me, I divide by that, so minus 1. So for every nu, and the nu is inside the potential here, because V is between minus nu over x and 0. So for every nu, I have that the supremum of the Rayleigh quotient over the functions 0 chi is always less than minus 1. That means that my constant A minus here, I'm going to make it equal to minus 1. So simple computation. Now I'm going to compute the other constants. Well, the second condition I already know, because I knew, I wrote somewhere, probably no, it's still there, that the first eigenvalue of these operators is bounded below by this square root, which is less than zero. Okay? And here in the assumptions, I want to bound from below these eigenvalues by some constant which is above minus one. So I can take A plus any constant which is in the interval minus 1, 0. For example, I can take 0, I can take minus 1 half, whatever. And I will have the second condition verified in the whole interval. And I have to verify the third condition. The third condition looks at the case in which nu is equal to 0. So no coupling, only A 0. No potential. Okay? And what is in the case H1 0? H1 0 is just the infimum over the positive space, so phi, of the supremum over the negative space, chi, of the Rayleigh quotient, okay, with no potential. So no potential means that I have phi square minus chi square plus two real. Well, before I write this, let me just make a remark: is that when I write lambda one of nu of some operator, okay, I have the inf over f plus t plus in f plus supremum of the Rayleigh quotient in the space generated by E plus direct sum with F minus. But this is supremum on F minus, okay? So I can always take the zero element of F minus. So this is always bounded below, but the infimum of E plus of F plus of A E plus over E plus E plus. I just take, for the supremum, I just take 0 in F minus. Okay? So this lambda 1 is always bounded below by the infimum of the Rayleigh quotient on F plus. Okay, so lambda 1, 0 is bounded below by the infimum on the positive space. Positive space means that I take phi different from 0 and chi equal to 0. So I minimize over phi. And 0 means that I have no potential. So it's just phi square, that's all, over phi square, which is equal to 1. So lambda 1, 0 is larger than or equal to 1. Actually, it's equal to 1. Okay? And 1 is okay because 1 is larger than minus 1. A minus is equal to minus 1. So I have all the conditions satisfied. Okay, so in this case, I have seen that all the conditions of the theorem are satisfied, and so for this kind of potentials, V between 0 and minus U over X, for nu in the interval 0, 1, the complete interval 0, 1, the theorem tells me, well, I have to make the approximation then pass to the limit, but the theorem tells me that all the eigenvalues are equal to the min-maxes. Okay? So in this case, the theorem applies. And what are the what is the interest of this? Well, the interest is first that yesterday when I tried to solve this problem by a direct min-max approach, I couldn't reach nu equal to 1. You remember that in the theorem I proved yesterday at the beginning of the lecture, nu had to be between 0 and a constant which was 2 over 2 over pi plus pi over 2, which is more or less 0.9. So this was when I used the hard inequality to use direct variational results, I couldn't reach the optimal nu, which is 1. So with this theorem now, I can reach 1. Okay, so that's the first thing. And the second thing, which is interesting, is that we are going to see that things are much more explicit. Much more explicit in which sense? Well, in the following sense, when we are talking about eigenvalues of operators, we can have just a theoretical interest to prove their existence or to compare them, etc. But we can be people also who are interested in computing the eigenvalues. And computing min-maxes is quite involved, okay, numerically. So we are going to see that actually by this approach I wrote down here, we are going to improve the quality of the numerical approach to this problem. More especially, let's say that people who are computing eigenvalues of Dirac operators in molecular and atomic models, they don't want to use numerical algorithms to solve the min-max because that's very unstable, it's difficult to do. So what they do is to minimize. They want to minimize the Rayleigh quotient. But of course we know that it can be done, but this infimum is equal to minus infinity because H0 is not bounded below. But they do that. When you read many papers in the physics literature, they say we take a finite basis and we minimize the Rayleigh quotient. What happens is that they don't minimize blindly. What they do is to approach, of course they use a Galerkin approximation for this, and what they do is to work with function psi, which live in some spaces of finite dimension n. They increase n, but they don't take anything here. They know more or less what they have to do to avoid going to minus infinity. And this has to see with decay at infinity, boundary conditions, and this kind of thing. So actually, what they do is really minimize, but they have a lot of knowledge to know what they have to do to not to go to minus infinity. But these computations are quite unstable, and they do them by hand because they are getting different potentials, and in that every case they have to change the basis, etc. So these algorithms are a little bit not very nice to use, and I'm going to explain how we can use this theorem here to give a different view of these kind of things. Okay, so let me explain how. So let me, in order to do that, I'm going to explain how to use this new approach to compute the eigenvalues in a nice way. So let me compute now the lambda 1. Especially, I'm going to compute it for you. The lambda 1 of phi is the infimum, the lambda 1 is the infimum over phi, the supremum over chi of this Rayleigh quotient. Okay? So what I am going to do is to solve this maximization problem explicitly. This maximization problem depends on chi. Okay? I have the expression here of the Rayleigh quotient as a function of phi and chi. So what I do is a formal computation to solve this maximization problem. Okay? So I just look at the Euler-Lagrange equation satisfied by the maximizer of this, and I see that actually if I try to optimize this Rayleigh quotient in chi, what I get is the following thing is V minus 1 chi plus L phi equal to this supremum, I'm going to call it lambda of phi. For a phi fixed, I maximize in chi. So this number depends on phi. So the extremal equation is going to be V minus 1 chi plus L phi equal to lambda phi times chi. This is extremal equation in chi. Okay? And now I see that I have an equation for chi here. It's a little bit like the things I did the first lecture when I was speaking about the non-relativistic limit. So I can isolate here chi and say that chi is equal to L phi over 1 plus lambda phi minus phi. Okay? So this would be the extremal chi for a given phi. So this is the maximizer of this maximization problem. So I have this is the extremum chi for a given phi, and now I can insert this in the Rayleigh quotient to get an expression for the maximum, for this maximum here. So finally what I get if I do all the computations, I'm not going to do all in detail, but what I get is the following thing. What I get is that this lambda phi, which is the supremum of the Rayleigh quotient over chi, is given by the following formula. Lambda phi is times the integral of phi square is equal to this integral. Okay, so it's given by this. This is a formula. I'm given phi. And I solve this equation. I have this number lambda, which is here, and here in the denominator. Okay, this equation has a unique solution. So this is a constant. If you want, this is a constant. And it's here also. So I can't solve it explicitly. I can't give you the split in a closed form, the solution of this. But this equation, this is equation for this constant, has a unique solution. Why? Well, because here on the left-hand side, we have an increasing function in lambda. okay, because it multiplies a positive constant, phi given. And on the right-hand side, this part doesn't depend on lambda, and here I have it in the denominator, multiplied by positive constants, positive things, so it's a decreasing function. So as a function of lambda, this is the crossing of an increasing function and a decreasing function, so it's a unique point where they cut. So this equation defines completely lambda phi. This is uniquely defined by this equation. So I don't have an explicit expression of lambda phi. I can't tell you that lambda phi is the integral of this and that, but I tell you that it's the unique solution of this equation. Okay? And now, what the theorem tells us is that lambda 1, so the first eigenvalue, is equal to the minimum of these things. So lambda 1 is the minimum of lambda phi for all phis in C infinity support, compact support from R3 to C2. So we don't have to be in special subspaces taking care of boundary conditions or these kind of things. I take any phi which is different from zero. I compute the solution of this equation. Numerically, it's quite easy to do that. And then I minimize this.
Why is that not just an infimum?
It's an infimum. Thank you. And this changes life completely, because now we have a minimization problem to solve the first eigenvalue. Of course, we have minimization of something which is not explicitly defined, but this is defined by this formula here. So it's quite easy to write an algorithm to approach the first eigenvalue. And there is no worry about going to minus infinity or things like that. We know that this thing is a theorem, okay? So we just have to use our favorite minimization algorithm to approach the lambda ones. Okay, so this is the first interest of the theorem, is that we have, by using this decomposition here and applying the theorem, we give now a minimization description of the first eigenvalue. That's quite interesting in the applications. This is the first thing. The second thing is that we have this formula here, and this formula, I mean, there is some kind of mystery, because I told you yesterday that we needed hard inequalities to find the eigenvalues, to control the potential energy by the kinetic energy. And I told you that the best hard inequalities that we knew weren't good enough to cover the optimal case nu between 0 and 1. And now, indirectly, by this continuation argument, we recover the whole interval 0, 1. So it's a little bit strange. What is behind all this? Okay, so what is behind all this is that, actually, there is another hard inequality, which actually we found as after we proved this theorem, which comes from the theorem, it's a corollary of this, and it's obtained in the following way. Well, it can be viewed it in several ways, but let me just say the following thing, is that we knew that the lambda phis were larger than lambda 1, because lambda 1 is the infimum of the lambda phis. So for every phi, we have this inequality. And with the assumptions we had, we know that we knew that this was larger than the square root of 1 minus nu square. Okay? So we can use, we can look, for example, at this equality here. We have a definition here of lambda phi. We can look at the case V exactly, for example, exactly the Coulomb potential. And we know that in this case, we have here equality. Okay? So I use the fact that the lambda phi for every phi is bounded below by this square root. I use this information in this equality here to get the following thing, the square root of 1 minus nu square, the integral of phi square, is larger than or equal to the integral of L phi. So L, I remind you, is sigma nabla phi square over 1 minus nu square plus 1 minus the potential, which is now this one, minus nu over x phi square plus phi square. So I get this inequality now, and this inequality, it is true for every phi in C infinity compact support of R3 into C2.
You said greater than or equal, but less than or equal.
No, it's less than or equal. It's like this. I mean, by using this, this here, because here it's in the denominator, like yes, it's, so it's like this. You get this inequality. And now this equality, where I can pass this term, for example, to the left-hand side, and what I get is the following. So I want to write it like this. And here I write it like this, so it's R minus phi squared plus, plus a nu over x phi squared. Okay, so I get this inequality here. And this is, I'm going to try to convince you, a new hard inequality in some sense. Which is not homogeneous in X. You see that there are different homogeneities in the space. Not homogeneous in X. And I'm trying to relate it to more well-known hard inequalities. So assume, for example, to make things to... So this is the new hard inequality we found indirectly through the proof. And suppose, for example, that we see that what is puzzling here is that we have terms with different homogeneity in X. For example, in the denominator here, we have constants, and we have this potential here. Okay, suppose, for example, we want to look what happens for functions which live near the origin or near the infinity... phi squared here, yes. Well, not important. So imagine, for example, that now I have this, this is inequality, which is true for every phi. Imagine that I take now phis which live near the origin. Okay, so they are going just to see, I mean, for example, near the origin, the denominator is very close, is equivalent to nu over x. The constant will be very negligible with respect to the nu over x. Okay? And this term will be also negligible with respect to this one. So formally, if you take functions phi which have compact supports, near, so you make a concentration near the origin, what you are going to find formally is the following thing, nu over x phi squared less than sigma nabla phi squared over, so it's over nu over x, so it's multiplied by x, and divide by nu, and I pass the nu here. Okay? And if I take the limit nu going to 1, which I can, because this is true for every nu, so if I take the limit nu going to 1, I get this inequality for every phi. So, well, I have to concentrate and do the things properly, but I have to concentrate near the origin, and I get this inequality now here. And this is a more common hard inequality, which you can find, for example, in Hardy Littlewood's book, which is, well, in Hardy Littlewood's book, what you find is the following, is that phi squared over x in dimension 3 is less than modulus of x gradient phi squared. And the best constant is 1. Here is 1. In this inequality. And this is practically the same, just because in this integral, well, you don't have exactly nabla here, because you have something which the rotations intervene in this sigma, but it's a first order operator, the same homogeneity. So this inequality and this one is exactly the same kind. And actually, this hard inequality, which is classical, so it's in this old book, is equivalent. It's very easy to pass from this. A good change of functions is very easy to pass from this to the usual one, gradient phi squared larger than 1/4 phi squared of x squared, just by changing the function in the right way. So the classical one, which is equivalent to this one, is actually a limiting hard inequality that we obtain through our hard inequality here. Okay, so this inequality is much larger. It contains that one in particular for functions phi which are concentrated near the origin. Okay? And actually what happens if we want to come back to our discussions about why these theorems help us to improve the result is that actually we can go back now to the min-max problem, and by using this new hard inequality, we would be able to solve the problem for all nu's between 0 and 1. So this hard inequality is better than that one, in some sense. It contains that one in particular. But it's much more general for different phis. So if we knew in advance this hard inequality, we would have been able to look at the min-max directly in a variational approach and solve the problem directly, variationally, for the whole range of parameters. But we didn't know this in advance because this is an outcome, a corollary of our result. And we show that the fact that the first eigenvalue is larger than what we know is equivalent to this hardy type inequality. And of course, I did all this for the splitting, which is the splitting in the upper and the lower component. But we can do the same thing with all kinds of splittings, our favorite ones. This one is the nicest one because all the computations are really very easy to do. But you could use the same ideas with the spectral decomposition that I introduced yesterday, for example. And in that case, you could get a hard inequality which is different from this one, and which is I don't have time to write it down. It's a quite complicated hard inequality which contains in particular the classical ones. So these are hard inequalities which are not homogeneous in space and contain as a limit the classical hard inequalities which are invariant by dilation. Okay, these ones are not invariant by dilation. So we can construct like that a whole family of new hard inequalities which are optimal, these ones. Okay, so this is another output of this approach, apart from the fact that we can compute the eigenvalues now better and more safely numerically. And also, I maybe want to finish in the minutes which remain. I want to explain a little bit how to use this kind of approach in general, because as I told you the other day, this approach we could use not only for Dirac operators, but for any case in which we have self-adjoint operators with gaps in the essential spectrum. For example, if we have Schrödinger operators with periodic potentials, and the periodic potential creates, opens gaps in the spectrum, we could use this kind of approach to characterize the eigenvalues in the gaps. If, for example, in solid-state physics, when we have bands which are opened in the spectrum. Okay, and in those contexts, people are having a lot of difficulties to compute the eigenvalues numerically. So we think that this can be an approach to overcome those difficulties. So the idea here is the following. In general, so you have an operator which has maybe several gaps in the spectrum. And you add some, so you have an operator which has only essential spectrum, and you add some potential. Okay. Maybe it was the potential which creates the gaps, by the way. And then this constant nu, you want to move it. And if the potential is not too large, when nu is very, very, very small, this coupling constant is very small, the eigenvalues, if they appear in the gap, will be very close to that CC to C, to the border of the gaps. It will be maybe around these places, when nu is very small. Okay? And when we increase nu, they are going to move. They are going to go to the right, to the left, depending on the sign of the potential. So the idea of this theorem that we proved is the following. Is that we have a situation like this, and we know that we are working in a set of, for example, imagine that we are working R plus, have this parameter of R, R plus, for example. And the theory, what it says is the following thing. We increase the nu, and we are getting to, we are starting to see eigenvalues in the gaps. And what the theorem says is that we have to keep track of two things. First, we have to be sure that when we increase our parameter, we stay self-adjoint. So one of our problems is to be sure that when increasing the parameter, we stay self-adjoint. That's really fundamental. First thing. So as long as we stay self-adjoint, and as long as we don't leave the gap, we stay in the gap, maybe we are going to go like this and coming back, etc. But the idea, the general philosophy of the thing, is that as long as the eigenvalues stay in the interior of the gap, and as long as we stay self-adjoint, the eigenvalues will be given by the min-maxes. Okay? So this is the general philosophy. So we have to keep track of two things, staying inside the gap strictly, and staying self-adjoint. And to see the difference, I mean, to see how this works, I'm going to finish with two examples, because I'm always speaking about Coulomb potentials. Maybe you think that this only applies to Coulomb potentials. So let me look at two cases. The case of Dirac eigenvalues, the case I already analyzed, and the case A0 minus C X alpha for alpha between 0 and 1. So singularity which is less singular than the Coulomb potential. In this case, we saw that we had the A minus, which was equal to minus 1. We had the eigenvalues, which were larger than 0, for nu between 0 and 1. And 0 is in the middle of the gap. Remember that in the case of the Dirac operator, the gap is minus 1, 1. So I am still here. My eigenvalues are going down, down, down. They are the square roots of 1 minus nu square. They're going down, and I reach 1. Because when nu goes to 1, the eigenvalue goes to 0. And I was saying, I was telling you that I can go on safely as long as I don't leave the gap. And 0 is really in the middle of the gap. I have no problems at 0. What happens at 0? What happens is that when nu goes to 1, I don't have self-adjointness anymore. So I have to keep track really of both things. Staying in the middle of the gap and being self-adjoint. In the case of the Coulomb potential for the Dirac operator, what happens is that when nu increases, I reach 0, which is safe, but it's not safe for the self-adjointness. So I have to stop the process, the continuation argument, because even if I was still in the middle of the gap, I lost self-adjointness. In this case, the situation is quite different, because the potential is less singular, and in particular, it's compact with respect to H0. And so in this case, what happens is the same. It's the same thing. I have my gap here, minus 1, 1. So I take a fixed alpha, a fixed constant, which is between 0 and 1. So I have something which is less singular than Coulomb potential. And what I see is that for C very small, I will have eigenvalues here, an infinity of them. And they will be given by the min-maxes, by the theorem. And here, in this case, there is no problem with self-adjointness, because the fact that I have less singularity allows to prove that this is self-adjoint for every C. Okay? Essentially self-adjoint, actually. And so, I don't have to care in this case about self-adjointness. This thing is taken care of by the fact that I have less singularity in the potential. So in this case, they are always self-adjoint for every C. So the only thing I have to think about is not to leave the gap. So what happens is that here, when I increase C, the eigenvalues are going to go to the left. And they will reach 0, and they will go beyond 0. And actually, what the theorem tells me is that as long as the first eigenvalue, which depends on C, on the constant C, is larger than minus 1, everything will be fine and all the eigenvalues will be given by the min-maxes. So in this case, the only thing I have to care about is about not leaving the gap. No problems with the self-adjoint. So in this case, what happens is that the theorem is different, is that actually what happens is that for every C, in some interval C alpha, some constant C alpha, the theorem will tell me that the eigenvalues will be given by the min-maxes. I can compute them as I did before. And this C alpha is the constant for which the first eigenvalue is going to approach minus 1. So the C alpha is such that lambda 1 of C goes to minus 1 when C increases to C alpha. So in this case, what stops me is the fact if I increase C a lot, I fill the gap and I don't have a theorem anymore. In this case, what stopped me was not the fact that I was leaving the gap, it was the fact that I lost self-adjointness. So this is the way one can use this kind of theorems. If there is no problems with the self-adjointness, then it's only being the eigenvalues living inside the gap. And as long as that's the case, we can increase the coupling constant, and we can use the theorem to say that all the eigenvalues are given by this sim sup, and then we can maybe use a nice splitting to compute them as I did here for the Coulomb potential. Okay. Thank you.
Interesting,
and there are
questions, remarks. Is there a nice splitting you can use for the case of periodic potentials?
I don't know. I really don't try, but in every case, I don't. You can always use spectral decomposition. It's explicit, but it's not as nice as this one. So in every case, you have to try to see what is better. I mean, we can write everything here with a spectral decomposition, and it's explicit. Only it's a little bit more involved. In this case, really, and I didn't say actually, I don't say, and I would like to say because it's something, somebody who is Canadian. The first time that lambda 1 was defined as the infimum over phi, supremo over chi, I mean, the kind of decomposition I use here, it was introduced by Talman with someone working in some university in the east of Canada. And there was no proof, it was in a physics journal. So he introduced like that, and he said, I think it works, and he gave some arguments for it, but they were not rigorous at all. And it was in 80, I don't remember, 81, 82, something like that. And when I looked at that, I said, quite interesting, but well, this is just a dream. It can't be true that it works. And after 20 years, we proved that actually it is true. So this decomposition is quite, quite nice and very, very easy to use.
Other questions? Okay, thanks again.